This is Janet Alder. In 1998, her brother died on the floor of a police station in Hull, in the north of England. 16 years later, no one has been held accountable for his death, despite there being an inquest, a trial, disciplinary hearings, a second investigation, and even a government admission of guilt.
I mean, they produced a document saying that these officers are guilty of the most serious failings, but absolutely nothing else has happened to them.
All the police officers would have been instructed by their lawyers that it would be reckless to answer questions and to potentially incriminate themselves.
Police station CCTV shows the final moments of Christopher Alder's life.
They do absolutely nothing to help him. And he's just dying on the floor.
Britain has been rocked by scandal upon scandal from its police force. The organisation has been repeatedly found wanting when it comes to stamping out corrupt and criminal behaviour in its ranks. My name is Michael Doherty. I'm a civil liberties campaigner and founder of Justice Now. I seek to bring about fundamental change to the systems of police accountability in the UK. This is Janet Alder. In 1998, her brother died on the floor of a police station in Hull, in the north of England. 16 years later, no one has been held accountable for his death, despite there being an inquest, a trial, disciplinary hearings, a second investigation, and even a government admission of guilt. Police station CCTV shows the final moments of Christopher Alder's life.
They do absolutely nothing to help him, and he's just dying on the floor.
That journey from the hospital to the police station is a very, very grey area.
They'd just not done an investigation. They had not investigated the Humberside police at all.
This is where our story begins. In 1998, a man known as Christopher Alder was involved in a scuffle outside this nightclub. It was then known as the Waterfront. Christopher was punched in the face. He fell to the ground and banged his head and was knocked unconscious. His injuries were treatable and Christopher regained consciousness shortly afterwards. The assault happened at 2 a.m. Within 2 hours of that, Christopher Alder was lying dead on the floor of a police station. Christopher's sister, Janet, has been a driving force behind an effort to find out exactly what happened to him that night.
The nightclub staff placed him into recovery position, you know, and tended to him, and somebody had actually phoned an ambulance.
His life did not seem to be in any immediate danger, but he was taken to hospital for checks. It was a short journey in the ambulance of just 1 mile.
The doctor had a look at his injuries and he'd received a blow to the mouth where he'd lost one tooth, and one tooth was bent back 10 degrees, and he had a hematoma, 50 pence, the size of a 50 pence piece, a swelling to the back of the head.
This is Hull Royal Infirmary, the hospital where Christopher's night went from bad to worse. The police attended to see Christopher as a complainant, the victim of an assault. He was examined by a doctor and diagnosed. The plan was to x-ray Christopher and keep him overnight for observations. Unfortunately, Christopher was uncooperative and the staff were unable to treat him. The police put this behaviour down to alcohol and not his injuries, an opinion that was reinforced when the hospital authorised his release. Years later, a Healthcare Commission report would find the doctor's decisions to be flawed. He'd had no idea how severe the injury was, therefore it was foolish to discharge Christopher that night.
Their version of events was he walked in between them out, and the hospital staff contradicted that by saying that he was physically dragged backwards with his feet trailing. Once outside, he stood up, he's fully compos mentis, and he'd been told by the hospital staff if he'd calmed down he could have walked back into the hospital and be treated. And the police basically said, well, if you're going to try and walk back in, we're going to stop you, type of thing. And decided to arrest him to prevent a breach of the peace.
The police radioed for a van to come and transport Christopher to the police station. Another journey of about 1 mile.
on a supposed journey to the police station, Christopher come out fully unconscious with his trousers and boxer shorts down to his knees with only two buttons open, his belt missing, and he had more severe injuries. One massive big injury to his lip, he had a cut above his eye, and he had an additional tooth missing, and he is fully unconscious.
So how did this happen? He could have fallen during a journey or had a fit triggered by his head injury. But another theory centres on the difference between the story told by the police officers and the story told by the gateman at the police station.
The police said that Christopher was actually alone in the back of the van. Well, as they got to the civilian gateman, there was only one man in the van and one in the car. So, you know, the question is, where is the other third police officer? And as I said, by the time they get to the police station door, there's then three police officers stood at the back of the van.
So the implication of that witness was that there might have been another officer in the back of the van with Christopher. He said that he couldn't be 100% sure, but that was the impression.
Ruth Bundy has worked with Janet as her lawyer since before the inquest into Christopher's death.
That journey from the hospital to the police station is a very, very grey area, and an area that has always worried Janet and others involved in this case as to what exactly happened.
Whatever did transpire between Christopher leaving the hospital and arriving at the police station, he was unquestionably in a worse state by the time he appears on CCTV at the Queen's Gardens police station. Here we see him dragged in and laid on the floor, at this point still breathing.
All I were told is, well, your brother's dad in police custody, we don't know how his dad, it's on CCTV footage, but you can't see it just now. Then, just before the inquest, the coroner had decided that it was crucial that the family saw the footage, the CCTV footage, so it wouldn't come as a shock to us within the inquest.
And although I had talked her through what she was going to see, nothing could properly prepare her for what she did see.
And they just put him on the floor, on his front, with his hands cuffed behind his back, and his buttocks are showing, his trousers to his knees, and he's just gasping for his life. He's just heaving and heaving. You can just hear rasping noises of as if, you know, there's something stuck in his throat or something, and the police officers have just stood about, speaking about charging him with more severe charges, saying that they can't just have him there for a Section 5, and it's not going nowhere, and you better take him back to the hospital. And he's there for 11 minutes, and nobody does anything. They don't cover him up, you know. They do absolutely nothing to help him, and he's just dying on the floor. And it is not until Christopher has breathed his last breath that somebody then realises that he's not making any more of those noises. And that's exactly what it said. He's not making any more of those noises, lads. And it's only then that they then decide to put him in the recovery position and try CPR.
The paramedics arrived, the same ones that attended to Christopher at the waterfront. For 30 minutes, they tried to revive him, but gave up at 4:36 a.m. Christopher was dead.
Humberside Police began an investigation into the assault outside the nightclub. In their view, it was this that led to his death. The man who punched Christopher was called Jason Paul. He was quickly arrested, but Janet was not told about this development in the case.
He wasn't allowed to see anybody. He was taken out of our town and put in a completely different town for a month in a bail hostel. And later was to find that Jason Paul took the police to court, the Humberside Police to court for a wrongful arrest. And they'd actually tried to charge him to deflect any criticism of their own behaviour.
The police should rightly investigate all angles when dealing with an unexplained death. But just one day after Christopher died, a pathologist declared that the blow from Jason Paul was not the cause of death.
Paul's release triggered a new approach to the case. It was only at this point that the police seemed to seriously consider that they could be responsible. The officers who had been present when Christopher died were finally suspended. It was Humberside Police who investigated Jason Paul, but it was West Yorkshire Police who investigated the Humberside Police about their responsibilities on the night of Christopher's death.
The West Yorkshire Police were supposed to be the independent force. They were supposed to be questioning the actions of Humberside Police, and they allowed the van to be cleaned. They allowed Christopher's clothes to be destroyed. They allowed his tooth to be destroyed, the police officer's clothing returned, dry cleaning returned. No exhibits were done on the blood or fingerprints. And basically, they'd just not done an investigation. They had not investigated the Humberside Police at all.
It then fell to the Crown Prosecution Service to decide if any charges should be brought against the five officers. Eventually, they were charged with misconduct in a public office. What this charge means is that they neglected their duty without reasonable justification. Christopher Alder was a paratrooper, decorated for his services to his country. After leaving the army, he returned to Hull, the city of his birth, to make a new life for himself.
Christopher was 37 years of age. He was training to be a computer specialist, even up to the time of his death, up to the day of his death. He still had a lot of life in it. He was a very, very jovial person, a bit of a comic. He'd support anybody, and he was a defender of the weak, definitely a defender of the weak.
2 years after Christopher's death, the inquest began. The cause of death has still not been established.
This is where the inquest happened back in 2000. The British press were here, fully expectant for the police to be held to account for Christopher's death. Unfortunately, the police officers responsible for Christopher's care that evening were able to avoid answering any questions that may have held them to account.
Well, at any inquest, no witness has to answer a question if they would thereby incriminate themselves and lay themselves open to proceedings being taken against them.
But just because the police remained tight-lipped didn't mean that there was no incriminating evidence presented at the inquest.
We were shocked to learn that the forensic scientist who had been asked to see what blood exhibits there were about had walked into... She'd been shown a range of photographs by a barrister, and she said, "This is not the scene that I went into. Some of those blood spots weren't there. What I can see on here weren't there when I went in." So he then asked her whether it had an effect on her ability to decide whether Christopher had been assaulted in the van. And she said, "Oh yes, of course it has, because I'm going into a scene that's, that's not the correct scene. It's been changed."
The fact that neither Christopher's clothes nor those of the officers had been analysed was another barrier to finding out the truth. Without all of the evidence, the forensic experts had not been able to draw a full conclusion. The cause of death was much debated at the inquest, with various medical experts being called on each side.
Professor Crane came along. He recognised that Christopher had additional injuries, and he said there could have been a possibility of an assault or him falling in the van. And he said it was clear to see. He said you didn't need to be a rocket scientist. He said, "Just look at the video. That man cannot breathe. And he can't breathe due to the fact that the police laid him on the floor, left him on his front, and gave him no medical attention, didn't attempt to roll him over, didn't attempt to put him in the recovery position. Of course he's going to die." But then what the CPS had done is they brought in another medical expert and said, "Well, it could very well have been, he could have had a cardiac arrhythmia. There's no evidence, but we can't rule it out."
This led to yet another expert rebuttal, from a heart surgeon this time.
She said, listen, even if that man had died of a cardiac arrhythmia, which I don't believe that he did because he was a 37-year-old, fit ex-paratrooper, but even if he did, if they'd have given basic medical attention, taken him to the hospital, then we'd see how long he would have lived for. That's the only way you could decide something like that. That enabled us to get the unlawful killing verdict.
At the end of the inquest, the jury reached a verdict that positional asphyxia was the main cause of Christopher's death. In other words, the position in which he was laid on the floor caused him to suffocate.
The outcome of the inquest was fantastic. It was exactly what the family hoped for. The jury were thoroughly engaged during the inquest. They asked the most pertinent questions themselves. They didn't let anything slip. And then they came back with the unlawful killing verdict, which was a real high point. In fact, perhaps the only high point since 1998 that there's been in this case.
The next step was a criminal prosecution. In 2002, the police officers involved finally stood trial. The first interesting thing about this was the evidence that was not used.
This is William Wilberforce, one of Hull's most famous sons. He's credited with bringing an end to the slave trade in Britain. The monument overlooks the police station where Christopher died. It's amazing to think that racism may have played a part in Christopher's death.
Janet always suspected that there may have been a racial element in the police's negligence. And indeed, an audio recording from the police station did pick up racist language being used. But the Crown Prosecution Service decided not to use this evidence at trial.
The evidence of racist language and opinion was discovered so late that everybody was scurrying around at the trial trying to get different experts to listen carefully to the words used and to decide what the words actually were and what the connotations actually were. And in the end, it was a shambles. That should all have been done years before.
This was police officers in the custody suite after Christopher's death mocking a black man that were dead on the floor. And the CPS basically disregarded it.
The two charges that the officers were facing were misconduct in a public office and gross negligence manslaughter. To gain a conviction for the manslaughter charge, the CPS had to prove that the police had caused Christopher's death.
Normally, the CPS would go with the evidence that would support their case. What happened here is they presented evidence that conflicted itself. So they presented evidence to say that Christopher would have died, as well as producing evidence that Christopher would have lived, which is the evidence me and my solicitor had got. The judge said, what are you trying to say here? You haven't made a clear case. You cannot put that in front of a jury because it conflicts itself. Throw it out. These police officers have been acquitted on that charge of manslaughter.
The trial would soon collapse completely. It was a huge disappointment to Christopher's family. Janet certainly felt that justice was not done, and that the CPS had failed to put their full effort into winning the trial.
I always felt at the beginning of this case that this case was set to fail. It basically proved me right. And once again, because this case didn't get past the halfway stage, which I believe the CPS were well aware it would not, those police officers were once again able to evade answering any questions whatsoever. We'd had to watch 5 police officers walk away with the unlawful killing of my brother.
Looking back, it's hard to see how it could not have failed, partly because of the medical evidence muddle, partly because I'm still horrified today to find that even by the start of the criminal trial, nobody from the Crown Prosecution Service had viewed and listened to all the evidence that was available from CCTV relating to the custody suite. There had been years for CPS to properly prepare that case, and it just wasn't done.
After the trial, the five officers involved went through a police disciplinary on a charge of neglect. They were acquitted of any wrongdoing and allowed to take early retirement due to stress. Years passed before there was any further development in the case. But in 2004, television provoked a new chapter.
It was a documentary like this that revived the interest in Christopher's case. It provoked an outcry from the public that just couldn't be ignored.
It took me a long time to really get my head round showing Christopher's death on television to the public for the world to see. It was through this that the Home Secretary then himself had a knee-jerk reaction and said that there should be a review into all the evidence again by the new Independent Police Complaints Commission.
The hefty report that the IPCC produced echoed Janet's complaints and suspicions through the years, but did not offer anything new or surprising.
I mean, they produced a document saying that these officers are guilty of the most serious failings, but absolutely nothing else has happened to them. They've produced a document, and that's basically it, just saying that these police officers have failed Christopher Alder, and that's the end of it.
This refusal to follow through was nothing compared to the inaction that would follow. Back in 2003, Janet had taken her case beyond Britain's shores to the European Court of Human Rights. 8 years later, the government replied to the European Court with a very unexpected statement. It was a complete admission of guilt. They apologised to the Alder family, as well as paying compensation and legal fees. The government admitted that there was no effective and independent investigation, and that three articles of the Convention on Human Rights had been breached. Article 2, the right to life. Article 3, the prohibition on torture. And Article 14, the prohibition on discrimination. It was a huge admission for the government to make and a victory for Janet's perseverance.
But they'd been fighting me for 14 years. All the way to try and make out as if I was crazy, as if I were going on about nothing, as if I were just like a grieving sister that wouldn't let it go.
Were you surprised at the UK's full admission in relation to human rights violations?
Had they not done that, all the issues would have been up for grabs again. All the issues would have been ventilated, and I'm quite certain that this government did not want that. So, in a way, I think that it was the worst possible outcome.
I really expected the government to come and say, right, you know, now we will thoroughly investigate. But I haven't heard anything. Absolutely nothing. They've basically admitted that they failed to do what's right, and that has been the end of it. I'm a total shock.
Has any good come out of the Christopher Alder case?
Investigations that they have carried out, two I think in particular, for the IPCC into deaths in custody have been excellent. The families themselves would say so. And one very senior officer at one of these two inquests was to say in the witness box, well, we at Humberside have a lot to make up for after the Christopher Alder case. I think some good has come out of it, but in terms of justice for Christopher Alder, zilch.
In the year 2000, after the inquest and verdict of unlawful killing, Christopher's family decided the time was right to bury him. People came from all over Britain to pay their respects. There was a procession that went past the Wilberforce Memorial and the police station where he died.
The family brought Christopher here to Hull Northern Cemetery to bury him and lay him to rest. But years later, a horrible truth would emerge.
I thought we'd laid him to rest, and I thought we'd given him the best funeral that we could for somebody that they were hoping would have no significance. Wasn't, you know, his death was known and it was aired about and he weren't forgotten. And then I was shell-shocked yet again when 11 years later I was told it weren't my brother we buried, but a 77-year-old woman. How can anybody possibly make that mistake? I don't believe myself that it's a mistake. I think it was a punishment to me personally for fighting against the system.
Despite an investigation, there is still no explanation for how these bodies came to be mixed up. The Christopher Alder case is now 16 years old and has reached a strange impasse. The state has acknowledged that the police were at fault, but there is seemingly no will to pursue a new prosecution. This has now gone on for so long that one of the five police officers involved has died. The tireless efforts of Janet and the rest of Christopher's family have given them just a glimpse of justice, but real accountability still eludes them.